Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 4th. Our first order of business will be to approve the minutes from Monday, February 2nd. Representative Vogel moves approval of those minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, today is Net Metering Day. We're going to be doing an overview of net metering. In a general sense, there is no bill before the committee, but certainly this will be an opportunity to inform members on what net metering is, the more technical aspects, hear from some expert testifiers in the issue, both locally and nationally, and in addition to be available to have members be able to ask questions to these experts. Our first testifier is Julia Hamm. She's the president and CEO of the Solar Electric Power Association. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you. I'm Julia Hamm, and as you just heard, I'm CEO of the Solar Electric Power Association. So let me get this pulled up here. So to get us started, I think it's helpful to understand the perspective that I bring to this conversation. Our organization has a very unique role in the marketplace. So just to quickly share with you who we are a 501c3 nonprofit. We are not a C6 trade association, so we don't exist to serve our members' interests, but rather we exist to fulfill our mission, which is focused on helping electric utilities integrate more solar into the resource mix. We do that through a membership model, and so we have just under 500 electric utility members across the country, ranging from the largest IOUs down to many, many very small municipal and rural co-op members and everything in between. And those utility members also are across the entire range of experience levels with solar. On the other side of our membership, we have about 450 companies and entities that are interested in working with SEPA and its utility members to help utilities integrate more solar into the resource mix. So that runs the gamut from solar manufacturers to project developers, engineering firms, many state PUCs and energy offices are members. So we have a very diverse membership representing both the electric utility industry and the solar industry. SEPA's guiding principles, I think, help, again, frame the conversation that we're having here today. So these are guiding principles laid out by our board of directors, which, again, is a mix of both electric utility executives and solar industry executives. But the things that we believe at our core as an organization are that utilities are a critical part of the equation for solar energy to live up to its full potential. There are certainly many voices in the solar industry that are looking to work around the utility industry. We believe that by working with the utility industry, we can actually make progress faster and get more solar deployed more quickly if utilities are working together with us. We also recognize that the regulatory compact has to evolve. Utilities need to begin shifting their business models. And it really will be about a combination of both central station and distributed solar resources. It's not, we do not believe that one or the other is the answer, but rather it's going to be a suite of answers, even within the solar technology subset. We also believe that advancements in grid design technologies and operation are needed in order for solar to reach its maximum potential. So the way that things have been done in the energy industry in the past will need to change. And finally, we believe that the long-term economic health of utilities, solar companies, and customers will be strengthened through partnership. So we work very much on the day-to-day of our business in bringing the two industries together to collaborate, to look for win-win-win solutions, again, between the utilities, the solar industry, and customers. So hopefully that's helpful in understanding a little bit of where we're coming from and the perspective that we bring to the table. In terms of what we do, we facilitate a lot of utility peer learning. We help build bridges between the two industries. We also spend a lot of time thinking outside the box around solutions. So now to get into sort of the meat of big picture, what's happening with solar across the country. And I apologize, this is a little bit of an awkward time of year because much of the 2014 data, we're actually in the middle of analyzing that right now. So much of what you'll see from me, the most recent data is for 2013, because I don't quite yet have my fingers on the 2014 data yet. But the trend continued in 2014, very similar to what we've seen in the past. So what you see here, if you look at the blue bars first, essentially you've seen the growth of the industry and how fast, just in the past couple of years, the industry has been growing. And you can see that the industry is pretty well split between the residential, non-residential, and utility central station plant parts of the solar segments. And, you know, over the past, in 2014, if we were looking at that data, we would have seen a continued growth of the utility scale systems, the larger solar systems, becoming an even larger part of the market. Part of that has to do with the fact that there is a federal investment tax credit that is set to go from 30% down to 10% at the end of 2016. So there are a lot of big projects that are in the pipeline right now as a result of that. But all three market segments continue to grow at a very rapid pace. Then the orange line, you can see what has happened with prices. And prices vary dramatically across the country. So take that into consideration. But when we look at the national weighted average system price, and again, this is a weighted price looking at residential systems, commercial industrial systems, and utility scale systems, you can see how prices have come down. And today in many places, certainly the large utility scale systems in many places in the country today, we're finding they're even becoming the least cost option when utilities are looking at resource options. Again, varies in different parts of the country, not true yet everywhere, but we're starting to see it happen more and more. And obviously related to the conversation today here around net metering, what matters to a residential customer is largely what is the price of solar relative to the retail rate that an electric utility is offering to that customer. And in more and more states across the country, we're now seeing that the cost of solar has come down enough that solar companies are able to offer customers a solar option that is at or below, in many cases, the retail rate that is being offered to them by the electric utility. Just to give you a sense of the market segments over time, again, this is another sort of way to look at the data, just to show you again that all three of these market segments are very important. One of the things that as an organization we believe is important is to have a diversified energy portfolio. And when you think about that, you know, the utility industry has always valued having a diversified energy portfolio. We also believe it's important to have a diversified solar portfolio. So this slide here shows you the five investor-owned utilities in the country that have the most solar deployed in their service territories, and the breakdown of that solar between residential, commercial, and utility-scale projects. And so what you can see is that different utilities have very different approaches to solar. In some cases, that is very heavily driven by policy decisions. In other cases, it's driven by utility business choices. It's driven by customer interests. So there certainly are different drivers for different utilities around what their solar portfolio has ended up looking like. And what the opportunities are. For example, PSE&G is in New Jersey. Obviously, New Jersey does not have a significant amount of open, expansive land to develop very large-scale projects. So it makes sense in many cases when you think about the fact that a significant portion of New Jersey solar is commercial rooftop systems because they have a lot of big warehouse-type buildings in New Jersey. On the flip side, if you look at a utility like PG&E, they have a significant amount of utility-scale solar, and that makes a lot of sense. A lot of it is not necessarily in the Bay Area, but they have a very large service territory in California, and much of that solar is developed in the desert and in places where there's a lot of land available. So there are a lot of factors that drive how a utility creates their portfolio, but what's important, again, here is that For all of these utilities who most would say are the leaders in solar development, or at least have been up until this point, they all have a diversified solar portfolio. So taking a look at the comparison of utility scale versus distributed solar and some of the things that utilities think about as they're assessing solar options, you can see sort of on the first column sort of a whole list of types of things that a utility might be taking into consideration and what the characteristics look like related to utility-scale solar versus distributed solar, which would be much smaller scale, often, and you can see here, behind the meter, often customer-driven. But all of these questions that are being debated across the country today are largely around what is the future of distributed generation. And so if we look at the fact that right now, typically, most distributed solar on this first line here, the interconnection point, typically is behind the meter. Well, does it have to be behind the meter? No. It certainly could, and behind the meter essentially means it's on the customer's side of the utility meter. There are certainly areas where we're seeing utilities suggesting that they put the, even if it's solar, a small solar system sited at a customer's property, there's no reason it couldn't be on the utility side of the meter. And that drastically changes a whole variety of factors and really changes the way that the utility and the customer each gain value from the system. And you can there are many arguments for the pros and cons of that. But if you look at these other, we talk about the transaction. So here's the first place you see net energy metering showing up. So today, net energy metering is the predominant way in which, when we talk about how customers are compensated for solar energy on their own roof, net energy metering has been the policy in the United States that has driven the growth of the rooftop solar market. So customers are compensated by the utility at some predefined rate for the excess generation from their solar system that they're not utilizing on their own property. So, but there again, just like the purpose of this hearing, there's much debate and discussion in every state across the country around is net metering the right solution going forward? And I think you'll hear varying perspectives from the other speakers about that. So anyway, there are a lot of questions here around how is distributed generation, what are the characteristics going to look like in the future? And this is where the bulk of the interesting debate and dialogue that's happening across the country is happening. So I wanted to cover sort of three typical utility responses to distributed generation. And the first is to talk about a little bit about rate design in the context of net metering, to talk about some new alternative customer options that utilities are thinking about, and then also, even bigger picture, talking about changing the utility paradigm completely. So first, in terms of responding to net metering through rate design. So this is, I know, quite there's a lot on this chart, but I think it provides a good basic understanding of what the issue is. So on the left-hand side, you see typical types of charges you would see on a utility bill, from fixed charges, demand charges, volumetric energy charges, and then other sort of adjuster clause type things. And then in the middle column, you see a typical residential bill and what's included in each of those types of utility charges. And on the far column, you see for a typical non-residential customer. So this would be a commercial or an industrial customer. And the big difference here is where you see these generation, transmission, and distribution capital investments falling within the utility bill. So in most cases, when you hear the debate happening across the country around net metering, largely between the utility industry and solar industry, almost always the debate is around residential customers. Very rarely is there concern expressed by the utility industry around the fact that their C&I customers or commercial industrial customers have net metering. And that's because those investments, those capital investments that the utility has made for the commercial and industrial customers, those are embedded in demand charges. So that is much less problematic for the utility's business model than with a typical residential customer, where those fixed costs are typically embedded in volumetric energy charges. So if a residential customer begins using less or buying less electricity from the utility because they are getting a portion of their electricity from their own solar system now, they are offsetting part of those fixed charges that they would otherwise have been paying to the utility. So hopefully that's helpful just to understand some of the basic dynamics. And again, I think you'll hear the other speakers debate some more detail around that. So some of the typical responses, and I think you could sort of apply this to the utility, you could apply it to policymakers, there's certainly the do-nothing approach. There are plenty of people across, whether it's from, there are certainly some utilities in this case, there are policymakers, there are people in the solar industry that say, the way things are working right now is just fine, let's leave them as they are, we can address this issue at some point in the future. There are others that say, we recognize maybe there's something here that needs to be studied, so let's begin studying it. There are others that say, let's change the way in which utilities actually recover their costs, and decoupling is one relatively typical possibility that many states have either implemented or taken a look at. That typically, again, a lot of debate could go into whether decoupling sales from revenue, lots of the very differing opinions about that. Most, I think, would say decoupling, at a minimum, it makes the utility neutral, but it still does not encourage the utility or incentivize them to want to necessarily proactively incorporate more solar into the resource mix. Others, then, we could talk about changing rates or adding fees for solar customers. So this is, for example, what we've seen happen in Arizona. It's what we've seen happen in Wisconsin. So this is a very typical outcome of many of the conversations that are happening in different states today. Another possibility is changing rates for all customers. So, for example, many across the country of the rural electric co-ops have begun increasing the fixed part of their bill for their entire customer base, saying, we know that our cost to serve a customer is much higher than what we have been charging them as a fixed bill or as the fixed component of their bill. So we're just going to increase that for all customers. We're not going to try to necessarily address our solar customers in a different manner, but rather we're just going to increase our fixed charges for all customers. So there's a nuanced difference between 4 and 5 here. 4 is, let's try to address this just by focusing on changing something for the solar customer. 5 is, let's change something for our entire customer base. Another possibility is separating out electricity sales and solar purchases. So if any of you have heard conversation around feed-in tariffs, this is essentially a feed-in tariff model. Many of the value of solar, as you're all familiar with here in Minnesota, many of the value of solar models work in this way, where a customer will have solar on their roof, but they will continue to buy all of the electricity they use from the utility, and then they will sell the utility all of the electricity they generate from their solar system. And the price at which they buy electricity from the utility may or may not be the same as what they sell their solar electricity to the utility at. So that's another approach that many are looking at. So in terms of creating alternative customer options, we as an organization spend a lot of time looking at what's happened not only in the states here in the U.S., but also internationally, what's happening in markets. And every year we take a group of energy executives abroad to study a market. Germany, as I'm sure many of you know, has for a long time had the largest solar market in the world. And so we've been over there 3 times, most recently this past September. And this is a quote from one of the big German utility executives who sort of in hindsight says our biggest mistake was selling kilowatt hours like baked beans when customers wanted to buy a service. And so I think there's a lot to be learned from that experience. It is hard. I could talk for 5 hours just about what's to be learned from Germany, but boiling it down to 4 points on a slide, here are some key takeaways. You know, one thing is that you have to understand that Germany's utility market is very different than what we have here in the U.S. They have broken apart their utility business. So essentially they have their generation companies that own the big power plants separate from their transmission companies, separate from their distribution companies. In some cases, they're shared partial, there's equity ownership in pieces of those, but conceptually all 3 are separate. And the generation companies are the ones that failed to invest in renewables, and they opted to stick with old business models. And when we were there in September, they were very forthright with us, saying the German government approached us 3 different times. The energy minister approached us 3 different times in the early 90s and called in all of the utilities into the room and said, we are going to do this transition. we want to do it with you. And the utility executive said, you know, in hindsight, we were relatively short-sighted because at that point in time, renewables was still much more expensive. And so we could not get the profit margin we needed back then by investing in renewables. So we said, no, thank you. Go ahead and do it without us. Now, in hindsight, they're thinking maybe they should have come along and really been part of the transition earlier on. So those generation companies have suffered a big loss. Again, they also have invested a lot in conventional generation, even in the past 2 years, even though this transition is so far underway. And they really, as I said, already missed the opportunity to lead the transition. But there's still opportunity that exists, and more and more integration of variable resources like wind and solar in Germany actually is providing a relatively big opportunity for the transmission and distribution utilities to invest in upgrading the grid. So when you hear people, when you read a news story that says, the German energy transition has killed the German, or is killing the German utility industry, you have to understand the structure of their market. It's the harm it's causing is primarily to their generation companies. The transmission and the distribution companies, you know, they're going about their business and they're, you know, it's not harming them in the way it's harming the German generation companies. So coming back here to the U.S. and thinking about the sort of shifting role of the electric utility, today most electric utilities are largely sort of passive players in this engagement with customers around solar. And what we're seeing a desire from the utility industry of really transitioning to, you know, becoming first a trusted energy advisor, but with the objective of becoming a trusted energy partner and thinking about things more holistically, being able to go to customers and not separately offer them a solar option and then someone else separately offering them an energy efficiency option and someone else talking to them about electric vehicles, but being able to go in and assess for a customer, what is it, what are your energy needs, and what as a company can we do?
Okay, hold on a quick second here. Everyone hit their mute buttons. We'll figure out which one it is. Try that one right there, Bob.
There we go.
There we go. All right. Thank you. Remind your members to have wireless devices. Just try to keep them as far away from the mics as you can because it does interfere. So, otherwise, we have to do that each time to find out where it is. So, please, Ms. Hamm, continue.
Okay. So, anyway, I probably need to speed up because I think I'm still have a lot of slides to go, and I'm well into my time. So, anyway, you get the point, looking to move to trusted energy partners. So there are a lot of things utilities can do. We spend a lot of time working with individual utilities on strategic plans, thinking about what can we do immediately, what can we do in the midterm, what can we do in the long term. And I'm going to, again, sort of skip through some of this. You've got the slides so you can read the detail. But just some examples of things that utilities can do, and I wanted to provide. Community solar, obviously a big topic of conversation here in Minnesota. In many places in the country, the utilities are the ones driving community solar, and it is the utility that is offering that as a program option to its customers, which I think is structurally quite different from how things are happening here in Minnesota. But a lot of things that utilities are thinking about in terms of the future and what they can be doing. So the Minnesota example, in terms of a utility example where I probably would honestly be using this example even if I were sitting in Oregon or New Hampshire today, but it happens to be a Minnesota example, and it is a co-op. So Wright Hennepin actually has formed a subsidiary of Wright Hennepin Solar, or WH Solar, and they have three phases. In the first phase, they're offering community solar. In the second phase, they're offering solar to their commercial, their sort of larger customers. And then in the third phase, they're offering residential rooftop solar to their customers. And they're doing this through $0 down financing options with long-term rate guarantees. So this is a great example of a utility who is really moving full force ahead with changing their business model and being able to offer their customer solar options that the customers are asking for. So in terms of changing the utility paradigm, there are a couple of examples to watch. I've put up here Hawaii and New York. They're two of the states. I should have also put up here California, but sort of California, Hawaii, and New York are, I would say, the three states that are really the farthest ahead If you're not already following New York's Reforming the Energy Vision proceeding, I would suggest that. They're really talking pretty holistically about how to change the paradigm in the state with the utility industry, and it's a very collaborative process. Hawaii already has over 10% of its residential customers who have rooftop solar, and that is growing very fast. They also, because of its island nature and its isolated grid, they are farthest ahead in terms of having some actual real technical challenge around grid penetration issues. So they're on the forefront of they have no choice but to find solutions today to figure out how to ensure that they can keep the grid safe, affordable, reliable, even when their customers are making choices independently of them regarding their electricity generation. I wanted to go back to Germany and just share with you an example. E.ON is one of the big four German utilities, and if you have not heard about this already, it's actually a really interesting case study. So this just was announced, I think, right before the holidays, I think in December. But essentially, E.ON has made the decision. They've announced they are splitting into two totally separate companies, and they will keep the E.ON brand for the company that will be focused on renewables, distribution, and customer solutions. And then they will form a brand new company with separate shareholders that's focused on the upstream market, commodities, and power generation. And they're doing this. They have a whole slide deck that's publicly available. You can search for it and easily find it. Because they recognize that there is so much tension between these two things. You need a different... The business models are so different. You need a totally different skill set in terms of your employee base. It is very hard as a single company to do all of these things well. And so they have made the decision to completely separate out into two separate companies. So it's really interesting to see that evolution. And then I think this is my last content slide here. I just wanted to share with you one thing that my organization is doing, calling it the 51st State Initiative. And that's, we're doing this initiative, I'll explain what it is, but in recognition that when you are in a state, regardless of whether you're a policymaker, a utility executive, a solar player, it's very hard to think outside the current constraints in which you're working in. So you're forced in many ways to think incrementally about change. And so what the 51st State Initiative is a effort where we are asking people to think about starting with a blank slate. If there were a brand new 51st state that did not have pre-existing electricity market design, did not have pre-existing utility rate structures, how would people want to design things to ensure that customers have safe, affordable, reliable power, but also optimize the use of distributed energy resources? So this is a crowdsourcing effort. We have more than 40 entities across the country, all experts in energy, who are planning to submit concepts to us. And the long-term path for this is eventually we will have a suite of roadmaps developed that policymakers and utility executives and others will be able to look at and pick the roadmap that is closest to your scenario and begin to be able to tweak it for your own state and begin to make some policy decisions around that. So our hope is by next summer, so summer of 2016, we will have that suite of roadmaps available. So really interesting stuff. The concepts that come in will all be publicly available. We'll be promoting them this summer. So by May, we'll have some really interesting ideas to share with everyone. So just some key takeaways. Solar's growing fast. Diverse solar portfolios are a good thing. We encourage people to think about finding ways to encourage continued growth of both utility-scale solar and distributed solar. Distributed solar can create challenges under the current utility paradigm, so everybody needs to be able to want to come to the table collectively and in a constructive way, look for solutions that are a win for the utility, the solar industry, and the customer. And finally, just that utilities are shifting the way that they approach their business. They're thinking very differently about things, and that's hard. So it's going to take some time to work through that, but I think that that's where, again, the collaborative approach really can benefit everybody if we all put our minds together and really look to have positive, fruitful conversations rather than always just having contentious adversarial relationships. And that's it. I stuck in here a list of resources for all of you, just so you've got it in the link. I would recommend the first one on there for all of you. It might put you to sleep, so don't read it in bed.
That's a heck of a sales pitch.
But seriously, as you're about to undertake some serious work around the net metering issue, I really encourage you to read this first paper. It is a primer. It's designed as a primer. It was written with policymakers in mind. And it was a collaborative effort that was a working group effort that was utility executives, utility rate designers, and the solar industry who all came together to put this together to make sure that policymakers like you understood the basic things you need to know before you try to tackle these issues.
And Ms. Hamm, first of all, thank you for your testimony. You're going to be here till the end of the meeting.
Yes.
For questions.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect.
Yep.
And members, you should know that the chair has provided copies of that report in your handout, so you can do that wonderful nighttime reading, or maybe you want to read to your spouse or something like that. So thank you very much.
Treadmill, or
yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Yeah, thank you,
Lynn Henkel, the policy director from NCEA. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to address you this afternoon on providing an overview of net metering in Minnesota. I want to begin by thanking the chair for some outstanding policy work around EV charging rates last session. I asked in advance if it was okay to provide a compliment, and he indicated that that would not be too risky.
Well, that concludes your testimony today. Thank you very much. The next, go ahead, Mr. Nicholson.
If that's all I have to say, and it goes that well, I'm totally aligned with that. As the chair indicated, my name is Lynn Henkel. I'm policy director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association. MNSEA is a membership organization that represents the entire solar value chain in Minnesota. We're proud to have over 80 members. These members include manufacturers, they include installers, they include financiers, they include utilities. We're proud of the fact that we've got that diversity. We're proud of the fact that we've been engaged with our utility partners and other segments of the industry for since 2009, and I'm going to talk about that some today because I think it's a really critical piece of the message about what homegrown, Minnesota-grown policy around energy can look like when people sit down at the table, engage one another in respectful dialogue. What you see in front of you, and I think you've all got 216B.164 in your packet, that's what I'm going to walk through. So as I refer to the subdivisions, take a look at that. I'm going to not get too far into the weeds. I was advised that today is a preliminary discussion about net metering. So I'm characterizing this as net metering 101. I'm happy to go as deep as people want or as detailed into some of the subdivisions. I'm more likely to spend time this afternoon talking about value of solar, which is a pretty significant part of this statute. Let me begin by indicating a thank you to Julia for a really great overview, and I'd like to say that at least in Minnesota, through the collaboration of all the parties that include those that I just mentioned, but also the legislators over the years, including many in this room, who have worked very hard to craft a renewable energy policy for our state. The agencies have been incredibly supportive. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the outstanding work done by Department of Commerce, Division of Energy Resources, in particular Deputy Commissioner Grant. We're well on our way in this state to accomplishing two of those objectives that Julia talked about. It may be a hybrid of the net metering rate making that she talked about as the first point, But clearly, we're very engaged in alternatives for customers, alternative products, alternative approaches. I'm going to talk a little bit about that later, as I indicated, when we get into talking about value of solar. But we're also extremely excited about what has been characterized as the E21 initiative. Julia didn't pull that out in her slides, but we're really, we believe, one of the lead states in working to change the paradigm, the business model, if you will, for utilities. I think you're going to see some legislation that hopefully will be embraced by this committee as the session goes forward, and we're very supportive of that initiative and some of the activities that are going to be made foundational by that. So let's get into the 216B164. Everybody have that in front of them? You know, let's go directly through the definitions. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I think everybody here understands how critical definitions are. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them. We can come back to that if folks want to. But the one that I'm most interested in here is G, designated meter. I'm going to have to put on my glasses. Means a meter that is physically attached to the customer's facility that the customer generator designates as the first meter to which meter net meter credits are to be applied as the primary meter for billing purpose when the customer is serviced by more than one meter. The reason I pull that out immediately is that I think it actually helps explain the subdivision 4A, which is on page 3, titled Aggregation of Meters. I think if you just look at that definition, G, it'll go a long ways towards describing what we wrote into law in 2013 under the heading of Aggregation of Meters. So that's the extent of what I'm going to deal with in terms of aggregation of meters. Let's go back to page 2, subdivision 3, purchases, small facilities. I direct your attention to parenthetic statement B. I think those are, at this point, the most critical elements to pay attention to. So go down to parenthesis 1 and parenthesis 2. What 1 does is indicate that if you've got a facility, a qualifying facility of 40 kilowatts but less than a megawatt or 1,000 kilowatts, you're entitled to compensation that's pulled out in paragraph C. And what that indicates is that you'd be eligible for what is called avoided cost. And it's a pretty narrow definition. I'd be happy to walk through that. But what that essentially says is that if you are in that category, you're eligible for a relatively modest amount in terms of payment that is defined as avoided cost. If, on the other hand, you have a system of less than 40 kilowatt capacity, the compensation would be related to D. And what that indicates is that you'd be eligible for what is called average retail utility energy rate. It's a somewhat higher amount than avoided cost, but it is what is, it's essentially a blended rate for residential customers. We could talk about what that means. It's roughly in the 11 cents, a little more than that category per kilowatt hour. I'm going to move towards the net metering facility. That talks about who's capable, who's qualified to interconnect with the utility. One of the things that's most important there is that standby charges are not imposed in this situation for a qualifying facility. Subdivision 4, I think the most relevant or perhaps the most difficult piece is to look at the second paragraph and walk through, if you will, the ways in which the calculation for net metering would be done in these situations that involve co-ops and munis. It could be an IOU as well, at the customer's choice. I already talked about provisions in 4A with aggregation of meters. That was a provision that was written into the law in 2013. Then we get into those categories where I think you begin to see the collaboration, if you want to call it that, engaged participation between stakeholders, including utilities in 2013, as we added provisions into the policy. But before I go further, I want to indicate that distributed generation is not just solar. You know, we're really proud of the fact in Minnesota, as a solar industry, that we work with a variety of partners, not just utilities, but those folks that are supplying small wind. And we understand, as we go forward in developing a broader energy mix in the state, that some of these distributed generation policies are also going to be relevant to the development of CHP, combined heat and power. Just had to say that because I think sometimes the discussions get so skewed, and I don't want it to be misinterpreted. We like the fact that there's a lot of discussion about solar, but we're not the only people that are playing in the distributed generation world. So getting back to 4B, one of the discussions that we had with our stakeholders was that we needed to be careful. Julia mentioned the situation in Hawaii where they've got a solar penetration of 10%. That's causing considerable, it's a challenge. And they're in the process of trying to figure out how to reasonably deal with that challenge. On the main line, there have been concerns raised in the service territory for PG&E. At penetrations around 5%. We know that our partners in the utility industry wanted a cumulative penetration flag, if you will, to be set a little lower than 4%, but we thought it was legitimate to set that number at 4%. If people understand what we're saying is we need to understand that point at which we've achieved a penetration that may start to be problematic. It may not be. Hopefully we've got a way, and I'll talk about this later, to target the deployment of solar in the grid so that it actually benefits and stabilizes the grid to the benefit of the utilities and all ratepayers. Going on to subdivision 4C, we didn't just look at how to cap, if you will, or create the correct deployment of solar system-wide, but we wanted to make it clear that to the extent possible, we want the generation to match load. We heard concerns from utilities that they were concerned about what we call merchant systems, that to the extent possible, we should be trying to build distributed generation so that it matches load. And that's what we did with subdivision 4C, where we set a capacity limit for solar and for small wind, as I indicated, at 120%. That may seem peculiar, but as most of you know, lives change. Small commercial entities change. They may add a new process that they need to have more capacity for. There should be some limited ability to be flexible with changes in life, changes in business, and that's the reason for 120%. Don't need to talk about disputes. Having a uniform contract is really critical so that you don't have different contracts for different service areas, that it's possible for the industry to have a high degree of certainty. For installers, for financiers, for utilities to have a common set of terms in how these projects are developed. Subdivision 8, interconnection required. This is critical. And I think it's important for everybody here to understand that when a system is put on the grid, the responsibility for any changes in the distribution network, the feeder, the substation, potentially even transmission, is the responsibility of those people who are interconnecting. Interconnection is required. I think it's really important for us to anticipate the potential, as I indicated earlier, for targeted deployment of solar within the system in Mencia, and actually in E21 process, we've called that locational mapping, where you could literally map out the best places in the grid to insert beneficially solar and other distributed energy. We get into subdivision 9 is pretty much boilerplate for definition of municipal electric utility. Then we get into the fun stuff, at least that's my perspective. This is the discussion about alternative tariff, value of solar, tariff or rate. And this is a response to years of discussion, as I indicated, among stakeholders, beginning as far back as 2010, internal to Mencia, talking about what are the challenges with net metering? What are the issues with net metering? What can we do in this state to set up some other options that potentially can resolve some of those issues? And we heard from the utilities about an idea, and Julia discussed it briefly, dual meter, sometimes called buy all, sell all, bill credit mechanism, where essentially you've got a consumption meter being charged the applicable rate for your rate class, and a production meter where you would be paid a rate that is determined through a process, a stakeholder process, to be valuable for the utility to ratepayers and, in the case of an IOU, shareholders. How am I doing on time? I just want to check in.
Got about 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Oh, boy. Okay. I'd love to have an opportunity to talk about this some more. We've gone through a process in the state. We've developed a methodology per the legislation that was subsequently approved by the PUC, and that methodology then was used by Excel to put out a preliminary number. There have been subsequent iterations, an improvement, I guess you'd call it, or a change based on a recalculation by the Division of Energy Resources. There are 8 different categories in what I call the value stack. You know, we could talk about those, you know, potentially in Q&A. I think it's important for this committee to understand one thing, that the value of solar is not an incentive. It's not a subsidy. It's a rate. It was based on a number of formulas that are fairly well accepted across the industry that we've applied in Minnesota to determine how does solar benefit ratepayers, benefit the utility, benefit shareholders in the case of IOUs. So this is the story for Minnesota. This is how we work together. This is how we create value across sectors, across entities. We have determined that the value of solar, for example, based on our specific market conditions, not generalities, not indications from other parts of the country, not abstract, I guess you'd call distillations, but based on real, specific Minnesota metrics. And I'm hoping that, I suspect Joel will talk some about that, and I'm hoping the rest of the folks that are addressing the committee this afternoon will address the specific characteristics, the metrics that we've used in Minnesota to develop a complementary policy for net metering and an innovative policy for value of solar in our state. And with that, I suspect there'll be questions later. I think I hit that 2 minutes.
You did. Thank you, Mr. Henkel. And you should, this is a good time to announce to the committee that next Wednesday evening we're going to have solar nights. It'll be a committee hearing on just focusing on solar.
Well, it just seems appropriate that it be in the evening.
Yes. So it's a good time to announce it. And certainly you'll be part of that conversation. We, members of the audience have input on what testifiers and information we'd like to present to the committee.
Just one last thing before I leave the dais. As I speak right now, we're 5 minutes into a meeting. I was talking about this partnership. You know, Mencia is co-chairing, along with Excel, an implementation working group for community solar gardens. You know, it's the way we do business in Minnesota. It's the way we work towards making these programs work, that we don't just put it in legislation, we follow up with implementation, and we're proud of that working relationship. Do we always agree? No, that would really be kind of boring. But we've continued to work with our partners, and we'll continue, at least in the context, for example, of community solar gardens, to create the specific implementation path for us moving forward. With that, I conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Henkel. We appreciate it. Mr. Brown. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm Ashley Brown. I'm Executive Director of the Harvard Electricity Policy Group, which is a think tank of on electric restructuring, electricity markets, and regulation issues. That's a program of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. I also I live in Massachusetts because I served 10 years on the Ohio Commission, and after 10 years on the Ohio Commission, there was no way I could stay in the state. So I welcome the opportunity to be with you today. I understand many of you are new to energy, so I thought I'd give you just a brief overview of all the different professions and what the role they play. And it's a view from the French Revolution and five professionals that were scheduled to be executed on the same day. And one was a priest, one was a lawyer, one was an accountant, the other an economist, and finally the engineer. And the first to put his head on the block is the priest. And the executioner raises the block, raises the guillotine, drops it, and the guillotine stops. The blade doesn't hit the priest's neck. The priest jumps up, didn't hit the blade jumping up, and said, "God has spoken. I'm a free man." Nobody could explain what happened, so they said, "That must be what happened. You're free to go, Father." Then there was the lawyer. And people were really excited. We finally get to kill a lawyer. And the lawyer puts his head on the block. Blade gets raised, it's dropped, and it stops. And the lawyer reaches in his pocket. He goes, "I just happen to have here a copy of the French Revolutionary Code, and on section 32, subsection I, it says, one chance, I'm free." That's what the code said, so he was a free man. Next is the accountant. He goes, "You know, you've lost the economies of scale. Accountants aren't worth much. It's going to cost too much just to put the blade up." So that, you know, who could argue with that logic? They go. The economist said, "You know, why bother trying? Just assume it doesn't work." No one could argue with that economic logic. Finally, the engineer comes up. He looks up. He goes, "You know, I can fix this problem." So those are the professions you're now dealing with in the world of energy. What I want to do is talk a little bit about, maybe more focused in on net metering, and how net metering fits into overall pricing schemes, the types of products that are available in the electricity market, and how solar fits into that, or solar energy fits into that, and then talk a little bit about some of the net effects of net metering, and also a little bit of where it came from. There are really two fundamental ways of pricing electricity that are used in the United States. One is cost of service, and there are a lot of different variations, and lots of economists have different views. But basically, it's rate of return regulation. Some states they use price cap, but it's based on an analysis of what the cost of providing the service is. And that's what it's based on. The second, which we use in the wholesale market, in which Minnesota is part of MISO, and that's a good example of a competitive wholesale market, is regulation doesn't really apply quite as much. What's really important, what we've got is real competition. Where you have real competition, the market sets the price. So we've got market-based pricing, we've got cost-to-service-based pricing, where we don't have a competitive market, and then you've got net metering, which is neither. Where did net metering come from if it doesn't fit into the, one of these two paradigms? It's an accident of history. It's a relic of yesteryear, in essence. It's a derivative of three no longer relevant facts in the industry. One is that metering is no longer bidirectional. That is, you could run forward, you can run backward, it can't do anything else. We have much more sophisticated ways of measuring output, consumption. We can do it in a real-time basis. So there's a lot of... So historically, there wasn't much you could do with distributed generation except run the meter forward and backward. So if somebody put on a solar panel, what do? You run it backward when he's producing. You run it forward when he's consuming. You balance that out, and you have net metering. And nobody really cared much about it because market penetration was not very significant. And you just heard from my predecessor in the dais that market penetration is growing all over the country. And finally, of course, so the insignificance of market penetration is not an issue. This has become quite a serious policy issue around the country. How do you price distributed solar? And finally, solar panels were costly, almost the hobbies of the idle rich. That's no longer true. They are cost competitive. The costs have dropped dramatically, very dramatically. And so as a result of that, solar is a very real player in the marketplace. So that's part of the context of sort of where net metering came from. As those three points, the elements of that led to net metering that I was just going through disappear, as they're no longer relevant, that forces this issue more to the forefront. Let me put the issue in another context, and that is, what are the cost elements of the distribution tariff? Julie explained a little bit of that, but I just wanted to go in a little more detail in a slightly different way. There are three basic costs in the electricity bill. One is the fixed costs. Those are costs that the utility incurs to provide the service, and it doesn't matter how much you consume, how little, how much. Those costs are fixed. The cost of the wires to serve your house, those are fixed. The cost of the back office operations, those are fixed. The costs of the repair trucks to maintain the system, those are fixed costs. They're not... doesn't matter whether you consume or you don't consume. If you want the electricity available, the utility has no alternative but to incur those costs. The second are the variable costs. Variable costs do vary with consumption. That's why they're called variable. So the more you consume, the more you're going to pay. The classic example of that is the energy cost. You pay per kilowatt hour for whatever the kilowatt hour charges for those energy costs. And the third are the demand costs. Those are a little more complicated in one sense. But the point is, every utility has an obligation to meet your demand at its peak. And so you have to plan the system and incur expenses to put in place a system that provides your needs when it's at their peak. So when you think about pricing distributed solar, you have to think, how does it fit into these three levels of costs that you're paying in your electric bill, and that the utility expects as compensation for its costs. Now, sometimes these costs are not directly reflected. I think Julia talked a little about that. Fixed costs are often, for residential customers, significant parts of them are recovered in variable costs. This is an issue that's been around for a long time in regulation debating. But the point is, those types of costs need to be analyzed when you think about how do you price distributed generation. Let me focus a little more on generation specifically, because generation, you know, you think, well, that generation, that's simple, we're buying the energy that gets generated. Well, that's actually one of three components, and two of them are really important for, I think, this discussion. What you're really buying is two things. You're buying the energy, and you're also buying the capacity. In other words, even if a power plant isn't needed at a particular moment in time, that's because demand may be slack. But when demand comes up, you're going to need that plant. So you have to pay for that capacity, otherwise it's not going to be there. So you're paying for the energy and you're paying for the capacity. Now in energy, if you look at a chart on energy prices in the Midwest ISO, you will note that the prices are incredibly volatile over the course of the day. They go up, they go down. obviously, when demand hits its peak, it's classic supply and demand. When demand's at its peak, the price goes high. When demand is slack, the price goes down. It's almost classic supply and demand economics. You don't often see that as a residential customer in your rates because the regulators flatten out the rates. That's another debate for another day. But it doesn't mean that the people that are buying energy to sell to you don't see it. They do see it. And so that's can be very volatile in the pricing. It means that for energy produced to be of the maximum value, it has to be there when demand is at its peak. That concept, and I'll come back to that in a couple minutes, is critical to understand how solar fits into the pricing issues. The capacity value means you buy capacity, meaning your utility that's serving you buys capacity to be there when it needs to be, when it's called upon. And it has to have capacity either that it owns or has the right to call on contractually to meet the peak demand. This is a fixed ongoing price. And if what happens if the generator you contract with for capacity doesn't produce, then that generator has to do one of two things: either buy you alternative energy and provide it, or pay a very substantial penalty. If you're an energy company, you would not buy capacity unless it's callable. That's the only reason you would buy it. It has no value if it's not there when you need it. So another thing to keep in mind when you think about solar, because solar is intermittent, it's not always there. And you don't know, it's somewhat unpredictable as to exactly when it's going to be there. The third I'll mention just to be complete, but I'm not going to focus because it's more of a wholesale issue, and that's ancillary services, and that is the kinds of services generators may provide to maintain, to keep the grid, the transmission grid going on a regular basis. But for retail purposes, the idea of capacity and energy and thinking of these two entities separately is very important to understand the issues relating to solar prices. Now, what do we know about solar in a very positive sense? One is it's a non-emitting resource. When you generate electricity with solar, you're not putting carbon or any other pollutant in the air. The marginal cost of solar is zero. That means the cost of actually producing the energy is nothing. It's free. All the costs are basically the capital costs of installing and maintaining the system. We know it can be available in small and large scale. Large scale has some economies of scale, so it tends to be more cost effective than small scale. But large scale is generally viewed as a wholesale market product. Small scale is a distributed generator. It reduces any reliance, and this is almost no longer relevant because the U.S. is such a major energy producer, but it does reduce the need for energy imports. But the footnote you have to put on that comment is about 70% of the panels sold in the United States are made in China. So the panels themselves largely are an imported product. And this is critically important. The cost of solar is rapidly, very rapidly declining. So whatever support it needed, it needs less support today to be economically viable than it did just a few years ago. So let me look at solar, distributed solar, from both an energy and a capacity perspective. Whenever it produces energy, it has value. That's clear. But as I mentioned, the price of energy varies widely over the course of a day, and of course it varies seasonally as well. Its energy value is really a feature of when it produces the energy. If it produces it at a time demand is at its peak, it has a lot more value than if it produces it at a time when demand is not at peak. Net metering, by the way, doesn't capture any of that, and I'll talk more about that in a minute, but that's an important concept to keep in mind. Net metering does not capture the energy value, or if it does, it's pure coincidence. There's very little capacity value for solar energy because it is intermittent. It's only available when the sun is shining. And if you look nationally, and this varies a little bit, but not a lot, the production of solar in the United States largely starts ramping up sometime 7-8 in the morning. This is assuming the sun is out. It ramps up. By noon, it hits its peak. That peak lasts a couple hours, and by 2 o'clock it starts diminishing. There's some variation depending on regions of the country. But how does that fit in with the peak demand in most of the country, and I believe in Minnesota? Peak demand tends to be in the latter part, after 3 o'clock in the afternoon in the summertime. And in the wintertime, the rest of the year, it's more in towards the evening and sometimes in the early morning. Solar isn't producing at peak at the time demand is at its peak. It's not coincident with peak. So if you view it from a purely economic standpoint, its energy value is less. It's reflective of what the price is in the market. If it's not at peak, it has less value than if it were at peak. Why is this important? This is very interesting. What net metering does is it says to the I'll come back to this. What net metering sends exactly the wrong price signal because it doesn't promote peak production of solar energy. And I'll come back to this in a second. It's very important. Secondly, the subsidies for solar distort the market. Now, there are many subsidies for solar. I'm going to talk about that in a second. But using a blunt instrument like net metering, it actually reduces the incentives to produce productivity, to improve productivity. Because the more you're, so there's actually a study I'm trying to get my hands on, I was just told about it, that shows actually that the more that the subsidies and the cross subsidies, I'm not talking about the tax subsidies, but the cross subsidies from non-solar ratepayers to solar ratepayers, actually tend to drive up the cost of installation. So what's happening is the price of the panels is declining, the costs of installing are not declining at the same level where the subsidies are the highest. So if there's a subsidy, there's a lot of room for somebody to take advantage of those subsidies, and there's some evidence that that is going on in the marketplace. It also tends to reduce, obviously, the overall efficiency of the electricity market. You know, in Minnesota and actually in all parts of the country where we have organized markets, and that's, you're part of MISO, we've got extremely sophisticated prices that really create a fairly efficient generation marketplace. And the outlier on that is actually a net metering, which is a much more primitive way of setting the prices. Now, all I'm talking about in terms of subsidies for solar are the rate-based ones. That is, the net metering, if you use value of solar, what the criteria are, that could distort the rate. I mean, it could be precise, but it's somewhat an administrative-derived mechanism. Nothing I'm talking about relates to the federal tax credits or the set-aside-based subsidies such as renewable energy credits or renewable portfolio standards, which lead to markets for renewable energy credits and solar renewable energy credits, all of which constitute a kind of subsidy or financial support for the solar industry. But the first two are based on market mechanisms and on a tax. The third kind, net metering, and some of the value of solar calculations are cross subsidies from non-solar customers to solar customers. But what are some of the economic issues that relate to net metering? And net metering, I think it's already been defined, but it's fairly simply, when you produce the energy, your meter runs backwards. If you're consuming the energy on premises, the meter doesn't run at all. It's neutral. If you're consuming what you produce in your home, the meter does nothing. It doesn't do anything. So you're not getting billed for anything. You're not paying for anything. If you start exporting the system, that is, you're producing more than you're consuming, your meter runs backwards. And if the opposite happens, you're not producing what you're consuming, then your meter runs forward, and then you owe and then there's a balancing mechanism, so that basically the bill is netted out at the end of the month or the year or whatever the period is. So what does that mean? That means that the distributed solar generator is actually being paid the full retail price for a product that is not a retail product. It's a wholesale product. The value is the energy. As I said, there's, I think, minimal capacity value, but if you want to throw capacity value in, it's capacity. It doesn't provide the wires. It doesn't provide all these administrative requirements of having the electric service and making it available. So the result is it's a retail price. It's a price paid for a retail product as if they were delivering all the service of the utility, when in fact not only that they don't, they can't. They're not set up to do that. So that's part of where the subsidy comes in. And when they're either consuming solar generators or either consuming what they're producing, or when they're exporting to the system, they're not paying the fixed costs of the system. That's why the fixed cost concept is important. They're not paying those fixed costs. Even though they're using the grid, they're not paying for it during those times. Now, obviously, when they're buying energy from the utility, they are paying for it. But where does the revenue come from to compensate for what they're not paying? It comes from the non-solar customers. So essentially, it's a retail price paid for a wholesale product. It's also a price that has no derivation from either cost or from market. We know in Minnesota and everywhere else where there's an organized market in the United States, not only what the cost of electricity is at any given point and any given time of the day, we know at every given point on the grid what it costs. It's called locational marginal cost pricing. That's what is used in MISO, it's used in PJM and all the RTOs in the U.S. It doesn't exist in states that aren't part of RTOs. So those price signals, we know what the energy price is, we know what the market price is, and then we carve out this exception for a particular form of generation. And it tends to distort those price signals. It also fails to recognize the important fact that the costs of solar panels are declining. If the cost of solar is declining, why is that not reflected in the rates that the solar hosts are paid when they're producing more energy than they use? Usually, if there's declining costs, that gets reflected in the prices. In the case of net metering, that doesn't happen. It also tends to discourage energy efficiency and demand-side management, because if utilities aren't recovering their fixed costs appropriately, they're going to put more and more emphasis on recovering those fixed costs in fixed charges. Why is that important? Because if you want to promote energy conservation and energy efficiency, and there's certainly ample good public policy reasons why you should want to do that, what you have to send is a customer a price. The customer needs to see the price signal, needs to see the price, so he can respond or she can respond to the price in an efficient sort of way. So a lot of what utilities incur in fixed costs, they don't pass on in the fixed charge. Because the theory, and there's really two reasons. One is because you want the customer to see the variable prices so they can be more efficient. That's a good thing. And the second reason is because it tends to have a socially regressive effect. It tends to be, the higher the fixed costs, the more it's a kind of a, put in easy parlance, it's a tax on the poor, because they can't avoid it. So that's part. So there are two reasons why regulators generally haven't allowed all fixed costs to be put into the fixed charges. That, I think, has an adverse effect on demand-side management. But utilities, and just in your neighboring state of Wisconsin, you just saw this, are moving very dramatically to move more and more of their cost recovery in from fixed costs, so they're not exposed to a lot of these variables that I just talked about. So it's something to keep in mind, that demand-side management and energy efficiency is not necessarily have a common interest with distributed solar generation, depending on how that solar generation is priced. There's a California legislator, by the way, who was asked once about what he thought about. Net metering, and he said, "Well, you know, he represented a very low-income district in Southern California." He said, "You know," he said, "I don't think it's Robin Hood. In fact, now that I think about it, it's Robin the Hood." And the point that he was making was carried out in a study that was done by consultants at the behest of the California Public Utilities Commission of California. But also in a study I just recently saw in New Jersey, is solar energy tends to be used more by affluent people, which is logical, they can afford it, and the subsidies generally come from less affluent people. I'm not saying it's a tax on the poor to pay the rich, but if you look at the trend, it has a socially regressive effect, and that's been noted in a number of studies. The other thing that's so interesting is, and the New York Times, some of you may have seen this, a couple months ran a story about it. A lot of the solar installations, the rooftop solar installations in the United States are designed with a southern exposure. Why? Because that tends to be where you can get the most kilowatt hours produced. And under net metering, the more you produce, regardless of when you produce it, the more money you make. If you shifted the focus or the deployment a little bit with more of a westward orientation, you would produce fewer kilowatt hours, but you would produce more on peak. So if you measure it by the locational marginal cost price, that means the value of the kilowatt hours you produce is far greater. This is almost economics. In fact, it's so simple, it's almost scary. The price signal is produce kilowatt hours and we don't care when. And if you change the price signal more sophisticated, they can produce more kilowatt hours at the time demand is the highest and capture the highest value. So getting these prices right sends an important signal. And here's a case with net metering where the price signal does get you exactly the opposite result of what you'd want for an efficient marketplace, but also not only in the consumer's interest, but actually even in the environmental interest. Because if you're producing at peak with an environmentally benign source of energy, such as solar, you're going to be displacing more emitting plants, dirtier plants in simple terms, than if you're producing off-peak when the dirtier plants generally aren't being called to run. So one of the things in looking at the value, what the value of solar is it has to do with what its effect is on the system, how it reflects what's going on in the system as a whole, or how it affects the system as a whole. Now, the thing about, so interesting about electricity is everything's dynamic. It is the only industry in the world where demand and supply have to be instantaneously matched on a real-time basis. So when you produce, your ability to produce and when you produce is of extraordinary importance in electricity, probably more than in any other industry. But let me look for a second at some of the environmental circumstances, and I just pointed out one that's important. The other is if you look at renewable resources, what's interesting is if you're concerned about, for example, carbon reduction, and many of us certainly are, you'd think you'd want to find the most cost-effective way to reduce carbon. And yet there's a general view, and it's articulated actually most recently by Emery Lovins, who some of you know is the head of the Rocky Mountain Institute and a very important member of the environmental community in the United States. He ranked renewable energy resources actually in terms of their cost-effectiveness in reducing carbon. And the least cost-effective way of reducing carbon was distributed solar energy. Wind was more cost-effective in his view. Some people have a different view of that. Large-scale solar, I think in almost everybody's view, is more efficient than small-scale solar, much more effective, cost-effective in reducing carbon. And distributed solar is the least cost-effective. So if the concern is the environment and you want to look at those issues, then I think you need to look at how do we spend our dollars first trying to, if you want to reduce carbon, how do we spend dollars in the most cost-effective way? In other words, let's get at the lowest-hanging fruit first rather than start at the high end and expend a lot of money and then not have enough resources to deal with the issue in a broader way. It's also true, and Julia talked a bit about Germany. One of the things she didn't mention, which is interesting from an environment, she wasn't talking about the environmental perspective. Germany, as all of you, I think many of you know, has gone dramatically into renewable energy, and the result has been an escalation in prices. It's led to utility restructurings, but the other thing that nobody anticipated was use of coal. And carbon emissions in Germany has increased. The more that the solar and wind have been brought online, it's had the opposite effect of what people would think would happen. There are a lot of complicated reasons. I have 2 minutes. I'll be happy to answer any questions about it. But that's But some of this stuff is just simply counterintuitive. So I will conclude. What is the optimal way of pricing solar? And first of all, I think in solar, I think all of us agree, has a lot of value. Its potential value in the marketplace is only beginning to be captured. But there's certain things I think we need to do. One is solar producers ought to be paid for what they actually produce, which is when they produce energy, they should be paid for the value of that energy at the time. It's very easy in Minnesota to know what that value is because it's in the locational marginal cost price established by the MISO. There's no guessing about it. It's known. It's published. It's public information. It's completely transparent. Distribution costs, every customer, solar or non-solar, should pay their fair share of distribution costs. There's no reason why, if you're relying on the grid to be there when you need it, when you want it, then you should pay. Everybody should pay their fair share, and there shouldn't be a lot of cross subsidies between people who are basically passing on some of their fair share of the cost to other people. And then finally, demand costs. The demand costs of being able to serve the system at peak and being available when people want need the energy, it's a cost that's there. And solar in particular, solar customers in particular, since they generally are not producing coincident with peak, that needs to be reflected in their costs. If, in fact, they do produce at peak, that will reduce their demand costs. But it's a market-based mechanism, and if solar produces at peak, their demand cost, solar customers' demand costs are reduced. If they don't produce at peak, they're increased. That's how all the other customers are treated. It seems equitable to treat solar customers the same way. Thank you very much. I'm sorry if I ran over.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. And if we could have Ms. Hamm, Mr. Henkel, and Mr. Brown, if you'd stay there, just to come down. We have some questions from members. And then we do have Mr. Larson and Mr. Johnson set to talk, but I know that we have access to you later. May not be the case with these individuals. So first of all, Representative Scott, then Representative Hortman. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Ms. Hamm, or actually anybody, I guess, that wants to answer it. But it's directly from her slides on page 6, and that was the list of 6 things, you know, where do we go from here kind of thing with net metering, what are our possible responses, and if we do nothing, what happens? Who pays the costs that solar customers are not paying? And I think the answer has already maybe been said, but just wanted to hear your response, I guess.
Ms. Hamm.
Well, I think probably these guys would actually have differing opinions on the answer to that question. So even the who pays, it all goes back to the value of solar and how you calculate that. And there is a lot of, honestly, controversy around that nationally. So, you know, Minnesota obviously went through its process to determine the value of solar rate for Minnesota. But there is still a lot of conversation happening around how accurate are those calculations. And part of it is because, honestly, a lot of the data that you may need to truly know the value of solar, in many cases, is not available. And one example is, you know, as you get to higher penetration levels of solar, at some point, there are likely to be upgrades needed to the grid. And so but most places in the country, very few places even in the world, have gotten to the penetration level where those upgrades have been necessary. So we don't yet know, we don't have data that says, here are what the grid update, the cost to upgrade the grid will be, and therefore you can't say these are the numbers we need to plug into that calculation, because the value of solar isn't just about the benefits, but it's also about the costs. And so that's just one example of a place where we don't necessarily yet have actual data where you can plug it in to calculate what the value of solar should be. So in many cases, it's there are assumptions that are being made. And so I don't know that you can truly yet say exactly what the value of solar is with a high degree of accuracy. I think I'm sure these two both want to chime in on.
Mr. Henkel?
You're right, Julia. I do have a slightly different position. We're really pretty confident at this point that not just the calculations themselves, but that the methodology that was developed through a very rigorous stakeholder process that I have to say involved considerable input from national partners. There was an enormous amount of attention, rightfully so. This is a really important discussion for a lot of stakeholders, not just in Minnesota, but throughout the United States. So we got a lot of feedback, not just at the mic at the end of panel discussions, but we organized formal input. In the discussions, there was voluminous input, written commentary that was provided by numerous stakeholders, as I indicated, not just from Minnesota, not just from the utility industry, but from across the United States, because they understood the importance of what we were doing. We knew that eyes were on us. We know that eyes are still on us. We understand that it was critical to get the job done right. What we have experienced is some fairly general criticisms of our methodology to date. I've not seen one substantive argument with one of the formulas that was developed to calculate the value in just one of the eight categories that we developed to determine the, what I call the value stack for the value of solar. We know that people are continuing to look at this. We know it's being used in other states, frankly, because in our experience, people are saying they thought we did our homework. And to that point, doing our homework means that we found a rate that benefits ratepayers, the utilities. It's not a subsidy. And we felt like it was one of the ways to begin dealing with that rough characterization that comes through with net metering. We understood that net metering wasn't a precise instrument. We understood that it needed to have more precise metrics that were applied. And to the point of it being, is it precise enough? When DER looked at the inputs and then the output that came from Excel, they changed the calculation. They reduced it because they said, okay, we're not using the calculations, we're not using the formulas precisely enough. So to the point, is this something that we think is usable in Minnesota? We do. We think we've done our work. We think we've engaged people not only in the state, but on the national level to develop a rigorous set of formulas and outputs.
One thing for you. Sure. Yeah, I think one of the hard parts is that, and this I'm sure you can expand on this even further. Historically, utility rates have been set on historical costs, and this value conversation is largely about future value, and so it really is a fundamental shift in the philosophy around rate design, which is one of I think part of the big reason why there's a big headbutting here around this issue.
If I might, Mr. Chair, then.
Representative Scott, if we can hear Mr. Brown, and then we'll go back to you.
All right.
Mr. Brown.
Just briefly, I it is true that a lot of people are watching what happened in Minnesota and the calculations. And there's no question people went through a very serious effort. The problem is, and Juliet touched on a bit of it, it's all based on assessments of future value. It's human judgment, and then it's applied administratively. There's certain things that we know with a quantitative certainty. We know what the costs are. Those are verifiable. We know what the market is, especially since you're part of an RTO. You know exactly what the prices are. And so those things you know. You don't need to guess at those. The administrative determination, no matter how disciplined, no matter how well thought, is not a very dynamic process because the methodology is extraordinarily complicated. The collecting the data and doing all the right inputs, extraordinarily complicated. And it doesn't reflect the fact that electricity markets are incredibly dynamic. And that needs to be reflected.
Representative Scott.
I understand that, you know, from what you said, it's based on future value. So if it doesn't turn out that that future value is realized and it's and that value falls short of what the current value of solar is that's being assessed, does that mean that the rest of us that don't have solar panels on that have been subsidizing this all these years are we going to get our day to get our money back? I this is a roll of the dice in my opinion. And one thing that wasn't taken into account, as far as I know, on the value of solar tax was an issue. And I had a bill last year, and I'll probably do some work on it again here soon. But you know, there's going to be a cost of the disposing of these solar panels and the unrecyclable parts to the solar panels. So that's another thing that hasn't been, as far as I know, put into the equation anywhere.
Representative Fortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's kind of hard to know where to start. This is a much, much longer topic than we have time for to get into today. I just want to draw a member's attention to a couple points in Mr. Hinkle's presentation. Since we're clearly going to be debating the issue of net metering at some level this session, I think it really would do members a world of good to read the statute 216B.164. And I think Mr. Hinkle did a good job of pointing out the off-ramp that's in statute, which is at 4B on page 4, and the size-to-load provision, which is 4C. These are kind of catchwords that we're going to be using in our as we talk about energy policy. So there is an off-ramp. There is a size-to-load provision, which means you can't have somebody who has double the generation capacity of what their normal usage is. The idea is to offset the cost for the consumer. But most importantly, members should take a look at Subdivision 10, which is awkwardly phrased alternative tariff compensation for resource value. You should just cross that out and write value of solar on your sheet, because Subdivision 10 on page 5 is where we have value of solar. And the whole value of solar is contained in A through L. But really, the most important provision is to look at F. And what F does is it directed the Department of Commerce, the Public Utilities Commission, to look at and charge and pay the true value of solar. And it asks that the department look at the value of the energy, the value of the generation capacity, the value of the transmission capacity, the value of not having line losses by transmitting the energy over large distances, like what we do with most of our energy, and the environmental value, because there is a value to that. And we talked about that, I think, the first day or two of this committee in terms of the environmental cost of some of the pollutants in conventional fuels. But also, this calculation is also adjustable. Over time, this will change. And the department and the PUC will say, what is the value for consumers? Did we overshoot the runway? Did we get it right or not? The same people who come up with the fair rate for us to pay right now for the energy that we buy from utilities every day are the people who are setting this rate. So it's not a whole different set of people who just only really care about the environment. It's the same professionals who set and approve of the rates that the utilities request at the PUC, making the determination of what the value of solar is. And I won't even get into the facts in Germany, because this is another situation where when two facts are true at the same time, they must be related to each other. Germany is strategically located between Russia and the United States and decided to move away from nuclear for reasons that have nothing to do with liking solar power. And the uptake of coal has nothing to do with solar. It has a lot to do with decommissioning nuke plants. So that's a different geopolitical and energy conversation that has no application to Minnesota's net metering conversation.
Although the Germans continue to buy a lot of nuclear.
Mr. Brown?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Germany has closed many of its nuclear plants, not all of them, but they're buying a huge amount of nuclear power from the Czech Republic, from France, and from many of its neighbors. So I'm not sure they've really denuclearized.
Mr. Chair. As someone who's been to Germany twice with Representative Hartman, as part of a larger contingent, not just her and I, just to be clear, I think that the whole German experience is very complicated. There's a lot of moving parts to it. I think we could literally spend a committee just focused on Germany. But I do think it's important to I think Ms. Hamm had in her presentation that things have dramatically changed in Germany. And whenever you change things, one of the premises of conservatism is when you change things, you have unanticipated results, and I think the Germans would admit that. But their view on it is, yes, we know that we're making mistakes, and yes, we're learning from them, but they feel like their gift to the world is the mistakes they're making. Whether that's related to coal or not, that's a separate conversation. So,
Chair.
But Mr. Hinkle, before we go to Representative Johnson.
Okay.
No, go ahead, Mr. Hinkle, and then we'll go to Mr. Johnson. Oh. Representative Johnson.
First of all, thank you, Chair. Garofalo, I'd like to briefly respond to Representative Scott. We're anxious to work with you on that bill for recycling. We think the time is now to have that dialogue and that discussion. So Mencia certainly wants to be a part of that going forward. I think Representative Hortman, you're correct. I'd like to actually confirm or perhaps change a misconception. I think all of you around the table are aware of a recent development where the PUC confirmed an ALJ's ruling that the most cost-effective peak energy supply in a competitive situation was the Aurora project, which is a solar peak energy supply based not on future calculations, based not on some misty metrics, but based on calculations that are current. The PUC at least concurred that it was the most cost-effective option going forward. Now, granted, that's in the peaker energy supply sector, but we're beginning to see in Minnesota and other parts of the energy universe this type of development, and I think it speaks to its current value, not just anticipated value going forward. And just to, I think sometimes
I'm going to go to Representative Johnson.
I'm sorry.
Because we got Representative Johnson, Representative Lunin, Wagenius, and Fabian. So to the members, tighten up your questions. To the respondents, tighten up your answers. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given how complicated this whole issue is, energy production and use and so forth, I assume that within the industry there must be riddled with cross-subsidization. And without getting into the whole issue of whether solar is subsidized, but there must be all kinds of cross-subsidization that's going on within this area, and I'd like to know what that is and relative to the concerns expressed about solar.
Which testifier would you like to have answer that question or present?
Probably Mr. Brown. Looks like he's kind of set there.
Mr. Brown?
Well, you're 100% accurate. The electric rates are full of a lot of cross-subsidies. Some of them are just inadvertent. You can't measure the cost of serving you and measuring me, and the costs are probably not identical, so one of us is probably cross-subsidizing the other one. So there are a lot of things that get lost in the rounding, but in fact you find cross-subsidies. Some of them are intentional. Low-income payment plans, for example, are cross-subsidies that are. So I think what you need to think about is how do we minimize the inadvertent ones? And there's some savings by not worrying about ones that are insignificant. But the other is, I think, to think about the policy implications. If we have low-income subsidies, that's because we decided consciously to have a low-income subsidy. And we want to target on low-income people, not on all residential customers, for example. So I think there are a lot of cross-subsidies. Some are inadvertent, some are purposeful. If they're purposeful, they need to be transparent, and they need to be as efficiently targeted as possible.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question deals with the net metering as far as the financial benefit or fiduciary benefit the people that put the panels up get. How is that taxed? Do they pay any kind of tax at all on that? I know as far as subsidizing, people could contend that putting in roads to allow my employees to get to my business is a form of subsidy that allows me to do business. But the fiscal benefit my business receives from that gets taxed. I'm just wondering if someone in the up front here can answer that question, or if we could get.
Well, Representative Lunin, I can take a shot at it. I mean, when any business provides a product to a homeowner, whether it's putting a new roof on or a new solar panel, certainly they report income to the state of Minnesota, and that income is taxable, subject to deductions and credits. Representative Lunin.
I'm talking about the revenue that the property owner, or in this case, let's call it the homeomner, gets.
Are you
from
talking about the actual electricity that's bought by
right,
the
exactly.
Right, exactly. That is not tax representative.
No, yeah, the fiscal benefit that they get, is that taxed at all? Or they get that tax-free, as well as subsidized?
Mr. Brown or Mr. Henkel, in Minnesota, my understanding is that that electricity that is bought by the utility, the co-op or the muni, that is not subject to the sales tax. Is that correct?
That's correct. There is the potential with an investment tax credit or other actual tax incentives for a change in taxation, so that does need to be taken into account, but you're correct, the net metering or the bill credit with value of solar is not taxable.
Representative Lunin, do you have a follow-up to that, or is that a...
No.
Thank you.
Well, can I just, and so from a federal perspective, it becomes an issue of whether let's say if it's a specifically a residential customer, it becomes an issue of whether if they have excess credits, does the utility actually cut them a check for those? And if they do, this is actually a big topic of conversation amongst the legal professionals in the industry, but there is, most people are in agreement that if the utility is cutting a check to the customer, that is counted as income that should be taxed at the federal level.
Representative Lunan, then Lagunias.
The public subsidizes the installation of these panels. The public is paying for the infrastructure to get the electricity back and forth. The fiscal benefit that the property owner gets, however, they don't pay any tax on that. So that must be the win-win-win. Mm-hmm. It all goes to the same address.
Representative Lagunias.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of this discussion depends on which costs you include in your calculations. And I understand you're not including carbon costs, and they may be somewhat hard to quantify. But in Minnesota, the cost of air pollution has been quantified, and it's $30 billion a year. And more than half of that will be coming from the electric utility sector. So if you have solar, then the future avoided cost is going to be reduced health care costs. And I want to ask Mr. Hinkle if he included that in there in his calculation.
Yes.
Mr. Hinkle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, thank you for the question. It is, in fact, included in the value stack. When you look at the eight different components that are considered part of the calculation for value of solar, that was included. It was debated. It continues to be debated. But the PUC indicated that there was ample research done by the ICC at the federal level. They indicated that taking the mid-range scenario that had been developed by the ICC and incorporating that social cost of carbon in the calculations was appropriate.
If I could follow up.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Did that social cost of carbon, I hear you're talking about a federal using some federal data. Did you also use the Minnesota data from the Pollution Control Agency? Their work on figuring out how much air pollution is costing us in health care costs is quite recent.
Mr. Hagel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I'm not certain.
Okay.
That would be. I know that discussion took place during the hearing where we were considering the methodology. Mm-hmm. I'm not clear what inputs were used in the actual final calculation. I know what the number of cents turned out to be in that stack.
Okay.
But I'm not clear. I'll have to go back and look at the way the inputs were developed in order to get those outputs.
Thank you.
Mr. Brown, then Representative Fabian.
Yeah, I think the questions you raise are obviously critical and important. And there's a debate nationally about if Congress doesn't regulate carbon or whatever emissions we're concerned about, whether that should be incorporated in utility rates or not. But assuming you go ahead and do that, then my only caution is you need to be extremely careful to do two things. One is to make sure, since the system, the electricity system is so dynamic, that you really, in fact, capture what it is, what emission savings we're actually accomplishing. And the second is to think that there's only a finite amount of money we have to invest in avoiding pollution, and how do we spend that money most wisely, as opposed to sort of starting with the technology and say, does it do this and do that? I think is how do we get the maximum bang for the buck in reducing carbon or any other pollutant we want to reduce?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brown, thank you. Well, thank you all for being here. I just want to make sure I'm clear on the cross-subsidy. Let's just say that I own Famiad Manufacturing, and I've got 500,000 square feet of production facility, and I'm paying, say, 12 cents a kilowatt, and I'm buying my electricity from Brown Utilities, and you're selling it to me for 12 cents, and you come to me and say, hey, Dan, we can make you a deal on your electricity. We're going to buy solar from Garofalo Solar Farm, and we'll sell it to you for 11.5 cents. We're actually going to help you lower your costs. Who picks up the cost of that half cent on my yearly energy bill?
Mr. Brown.
Well, there's two elements to the question. Part of it, if you assume that all you're doing is saving on generation, and so you're not, then there would be no cost. If, however, you're asking, how does that energy get to you?
Right.
Basically, it's the solar producer in that case isn't actually paying that while he's exporting energy into the system, and so therefore the non-solar customers end up paying for it.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear, so then that would be reflected in their monthly bill, correct?
If you're a non-solar customer, that's right.
Thank you.
One last question, then we'll wrap up for the day. So the value of solar calculation we've talked about, what is the, on a per megawatt hour, what is the latest determination of what the price of the value of solar is? I think my recollection is it's 132, but Mr. Engel, it's important for members of the committee to know that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things. First of all, I would be remiss if I didn't point to the fact that while the value of solar, I think, is a really robust process and a robust set of formulas, it does not include the benefit to the state in terms of investment. We've got those calculations done through the Union of Concerned Scientists, and it does not include the benefit to the state in job creation and tax revenue. DEED has done those calculations as well. So, while I'm happy to say that the formulation is robust, it honestly does not include some of the other values to ratepayers that accrue from the deployment of solar. The answer is they have come up with the latest, and it's going to be recalculated March 1st, I think, the next filing to adjust the value of solar. Will go forward at the PUC. Currently, it's called the levelized per kilowatt hour amount is 12.6, and then that gets what's called escalated. So if you think over a 25-year period, it actually starts closer to 10 cents and then climbs, and at some point on that graph, it crosses the and gets to 12.6. So it's doing some math, but it's what's been developed as part of our formulation. So 12.6, but it's escalated. It starts lower.
Representative Hartman, you had a question for me?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The next hearing, the time and location. I was a couple minutes late to this hearing, and maybe you announced it, but I haven't seen it on the announced website of where we find out when our hearings are. And so I just want to know the date and the location and the time of our next hearing.
Yeah, we'll be noticing that. I think the goal is to get it noticed tonight.
Right after
committee, so it'll have the, I think we're planning on having the committee start in Wilmer at 9 a.m. Is that right, Mr. Kennedy?
Closer to 9:30.
So it'll be noticed, it'll be public. And I know for members we've been talking about the idea of having a West Metro meetup spot where the bus will take a route out and people can meet there instead of having to drive back and forth twice. Just watch your emails and check for that. The committee will be noticed tonight regarding logistics for members in terms of if they don't want to drive over to St. Paul. We'll have that for you hopefully tonight, maybe tomorrow. But as always, just check your email for details. Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, just the sooner the better in terms of logistics for letting the public know who might want to show up in Wilmer at what time we're starting would be nice to know.
Yep, and we'll be, I think our deadline for noticing it is Thursday. Is 72 hours? So we'll make sure we meet the deadline.
That's a four, not a
ceiling. Yeah, absolutely. The sooner, trust me, I want to get it done too. So any other questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, I want to thank our testifiers. We really appreciate it. This committee is adjourned.